1 Samuel chapter 26. I'm going to pick up again in our study of the life of David. Let's start reading in verse 1. And the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon? And Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way. But David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies, and understood that Saul was come in very deed. And David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched, and David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, the brother to Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thy hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him a second time. And David said to Abishai, Destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said, Furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. But I pray thee, take now the spear that is at his bolster, and the cruse of water, and let us go. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they gat them away, and no man saw it, nor knew it, neither awakened. For they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. And then David went over the other side, and stood on the top of the hill afar off, a great space being between them. And David cried to the people, and to Abner the son of Ner, and saying, Answerest thou not, Abner? Then Abner answered and said, Who art thou that criest to the king? And David said to Abner, Art thou not a valiant man? And who is like unto thee in Israel? Wherefore hast thou not kept thy lord the king? For there came one of the people in to destroy the king thy lord. This thing is not good that thou hast done. As the Lord liveth, you are worthy to die, because you have not kept your master the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is, and the cruse of water that was at his bolster. And Saul knew David's voice, and said, Is this thy voice, my son David? And David said, It is my voice, my lord, O king. And he said, Wherefore dost thou pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is in my hand? Therefore I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they be before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, Go, serve other gods. Now therefore let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. For the king of Israel is come out to seek a flea, as with one doth hunt a partridge in the mountains. Then said Saul, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, Behold the king's spear, and let one of the young men come over and fetch it. And the Lord render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered thee into my hand this day, but I would not stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Then Saul said to David, Blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt both do great things, and thou shalt still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul, he returned into his place. But I read the whole passage there just to give you an idea of the exchange that's going on. Several significant things about this passage right here. The first one being that, well, you know, it's insignificant in the sense that this is not the first time that it's happened. We saw probably, I don't know how many months ago, but several chapters ago, we found that David was in much the same situation with Saul in another place at another time. And there was a mountain separating the two, and they had another exchange, and that's when Saul could have come down into the cave to where Saul came down into the cave, and David was in the sides of the cave and could have killed Saul, and he ended up just cutting off his skirt instead. And so we find much the same exchange taking place. There are some differences, though, between what took place then and what took place here. And I'd kind of like to show you some of the things, not only to show you the character of Saul, but to show you the character of David and the men that were with him. Not only the good, but the bad. In this particular place, this happens in this event has taken place in the wilderness of Ziph. Now, does anybody remember in studying the life of David, what the Ziphites did the last time that Saul was in the wilderness of Ziph? Anybody remember what happened? I taught it. You got to remember everything I taught. Well, I'll give you a clue. They turned him in. Remember that? He was going to go deliver the city. They flat out turned their backs and turned him in the last time he was in this area. Gets me to wondering something. Why is he here? You know, there's an old saying, burned once, shame on you. I mean, burned once, shame on you. Burned twice, shame on me. You know, they burned him once. And yet here he is again, back in the wilderness of Ziph, as if somehow that's a place of safety. Now, it shows no motivation as to why David is here. There's no verse here to show anything in David's mind as to how he ended up back in this particular area. It could have been that he took Saul's word the last time Saul said, okay, my son, I'm not going to pursue you anymore. I'm not going to follow you anymore. And maybe David believed him and he went back here thinking, okay, well, this is a place of safety. But it says there in verse 1, and the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, does not David hide himself in the hill of Hakilah? I mean, they didn't even wait. As soon as David had appeared and they knew that he was there, they went straight for Saul. You know, it gets me to thinking something. And it's something that is actually a bit of a confusion in the churches today. And that's that somehow in the churches we have gotten the idea that the world is going to be loyal to God and to His principles. You think about it for a minute. What is it that a lot of churches are trying to do? They are working overtime trying to change public policy. They are working overtime trying to clean up corruption in government. There are some churches that their sole mission is nothing more than social reform, nothing more than trying. And I'm all for trying to make things better, but that's not the mission of the church. That's not the job that we have here on this earth. Some people say, well, we're the salt of the earth. We've got to get in and elect Christians and elect a good official. And then we get angry when lost men make unregenerate decisions. What do you expect? Somebody's not saved. Are you going to expect them to follow the laws of God? Are you going to somehow expect that somehow some politician that we elect to office is going to bring goodness and morality without Jesus Christ? You know, they are just acting according to their nature. The Ziphites. The world, I'm going to tell you something, it follows another master. Don't try to fit in. Forget about trying to fit in. You're never going to fit in. I remember reading about Joseph back there, and after all those years, he still had to eat separately from those around him, because even though he was the second most powerful man in Egypt, he still did not quite fit in because of his nature. You realize something? We don't belong here. This here is not our inheritance. And so, why is it such a surprise when those that are around us somehow have a problem with us and want to turn us in, want to stab us in the back, want to do us harm? We are never going to be accepted, and the church might as well get used to it. Stop seeking for social acceptance. You know what we need to do? We just have to do our job. The world's going to turn us in. Let it. Let the world turn us in. We're going to find out that later on David appeals to God. And God is a much better friend to us than anybody in the world. I'll tell you something else. We don't need the backing of the world to be successful. We don't need funding from the president's 1,000 points of light to be successful in the ministry. You know something? We don't even need tax exemption. You realize that? Oh man, that 501c3, that's real precious to us. And believe me, we try real hard, because that's the last thing we want to do is start paying corporate taxes on offerings. You guys are just going to have to double your offerings is all that's going to happen to pay the taxes. But you know something? We don't really need approval from the government. We don't need protections from the government. In fact, there are times when the government has come against the church in different countries, and the church actually grew and thrived under the pressure. So don't expect any allegiance from the world. Don't expect any understanding from the world. Don't expect any help from the world. When things are peaceful for us, let's enjoy it. I mean, when politicians make a decision that's good for the church, man, let's rejoice in it. But don't always expect it. The Ziphites came unto Saul. That was their master. That's the one that they followed. That's the one that they... And then, you think that Saul would come to the Ziphites and said, well, Ziphites, you know, I understand your problem. But you see, I've given my word to David that I would never hunt him again. I don't think that's what Saul said right here. Saul said, you know, I swore before the Lord that David was a free man, and a free man he shall be. No, you know what Saul did? As soon as he heard the news, Saul arose. Now, Saul's the man after the flesh. Saul's the natural man. He's the one that does what men normally do. And you know, what is it that men normally do? They go back to what their nature is. I remember in the days when I was successful for a while and tried to stop smoking, you know, and I had determined that, man, that it's bad for my health. There was no morality involved in it. I still wasn't saved, but I determined that I was going to try to stop smoking. And believe me, there wasn't the gum, there wasn't the patches, there wasn't, you know, I think all they had was biofeedback, you know, and behavioral modification and all that kind of junk, the little rubber band that you snap and things like that. And I, believe me, it was tough, you know. I did it. I stopped smoking and I felt real proud of myself. And I went 6 whole months. And then somebody blew smoke in my face. On a day that it was very stressful, on a day that, you know, I needed a cigarette real bad. Some of you guys know what I'm talking about. Needed something to calm me down. And you know what? There's all my willpower gone down. You know something? When it comes to fighting sin, you shouldn't trust in willpower. There are some people that have just a natural stubbornness, a natural constitution within them that allows them to be able to say yes and no. And it's just natural within him, you know, that there's some things that some people just seem to have more self-control than others. You know, somebody can sit there and eat 3 or 4 bites out of a T-bone and push it away and leave the rest. And there's other people that eat the T-bone and suck the bone and get all the marrow out and lick the plate of all the gravy and still want more, you know. There's some people that have self-control and there's some people that do not have it, you know. But willpower is not the key to fighting the flesh. Because here, look at chapter 24 in chapter 24 in, look right down around in verse 17. Here's the last time they were in confrontation together, and here's what Saul said. Thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded the evil. And thou hast showed this day how thou hast dealt well with me, for as much as when the Lord had delivered me into thine hand, and thou killest me not. For if a man find his enemy, will he let him go well away? Wherefore the Lord reward thee good for that thou hast done unto me this day. And now, behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thy hand. Swear now therefore unto me by the Lord that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house. You know, very different words than we find the actions of Saul in this place right here. The last time they were together and the last time they had a confrontation, Saul pretty much acknowledged that David was going to take the kingdom, and he submitted himself and humbled himself before him, and now we find just the complete opposite. But you know, isn't that what the flesh is? You wake up one day and you swear, you know, I am never going to eat another sweet thing again in my life, you know. No more chocolate, no more cake. I mean, it is it. I'm done. I'm finished. I vow this day. And it goes okay for a little while. Then you know something? The nature, it kicks in again. You know, Peter wasn't very nice about how he described this. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22. Very accurately describes the nature. 1 Peter 2, 22. He's describing the lost people here, and he's describing false teachers and false prophets. And in verse 22, his conclusion is, "But it happened unto them, according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire." You know, it's a very accurate description. I mean, you get these dog shows, and, you know, and I've never actually been to a dog show, but I've been to the stock show before, and I've seen them parade around cows and sheep and goats and everything. And I had a friend of mine that had, in his barn, he had built a separate area in his barn where he put the cows in for about 8 or 9 hours a day, and it stayed about 40 degrees inside this particular area of his barn. And so these cows went in, and so they got their fur all nice and thick, and he would get this special shampoo, and he'd rub their skin and everything. And I mean, you feel this cow's hide, you know. It wasn't rough like some cows. It was really nice and pretty, and they'd manicure it and do all these other things. But you know, you can make that cow look and smell good and smell pretty, but let it go and put it out in the field, and you know what it's going to do? It's going to snick its snout. It's going to stick its snout right back down into the ground where it belongs. And it's going to start rooting around for grass just like before. You get a pig all shiny and clean, put it back in the thing, and it's going to wallow in the mud just like before. You can make the flesh look like a Christian all you want to, but it ain't a Christian. You can clean up the flesh and reform it and make it look good before other men all you want to, but in the end, the nature of the flesh is always flesh. And so we don't fight sin by our willpower. We don't fight sin by our methods. We don't fight sin by anything that we have. You know what it takes? It takes the power of God to do something about sin. Your nature is just like that. Look at James in chapter 1 and verse 23. James 1:23. But if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man that beholdeth his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself and goeth his way and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. I'm going to tell you something. That's the flesh. There's the natural man for you. It's right there. You can go in. You can look. You can see what you are. And I'm telling you something. You've seen it all the time. The natural man may even be brought under conviction. Maybe he might even start feeling bad about his sins, you know, and he might start having even some sort of remorse. But, you know, there is a difference between the sorrow that's after the world and the sorrow, the godly sorrow that comes from God. There is a difference because of the fruit that it brings. And let me tell you something. When Jesus Christ came into my life, there were things that were done in my heart that no willpower could ever accomplish. Because let me tell you something. You don't by willpower fall into love with Jesus Christ. You don't by just sheer willpower have a sincere desire and a dedication to do His will. Now, you know what? The flesh is after itself. And somebody who is unregenerate, that's trying to be religious, is only going to seek to look good in front of other people. As long as Saul is in front of David, he's talking good. But as soon as he goes away, his mind completely changes. Don't trust the flesh for a minute. You know, the flesh doesn't need to be reformed. The flesh needs to be mortified. God didn't clean up the old man. God killed him. God put him in the ground. God buried him. You know what it says in Colossians? It says, mortify, therefore, your members. That means you don't feed them. You don't give them life. You don't do anything to them. You cut off all supply to them. You want to kill the brain? You cut off the blood supply to the brain. And the brain is going to die. You do the same thing with the members that are after the flesh. You know, where were we? 1 Samuel 26. But there's Saul, the man after the flesh, and he's back down there forgetting all his vows and seeking after David again. And you know, David is there abiding in the wilderness, and David is careful, and he understands that Saul is coming. At the end of verse 3 it says, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. In verse 4 it says, David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed. And notice something about this, that David obviously doesn't trust Saul. Who would? He should have never trusted the Ziphites. And if you're known as a liar, it's going to take you a long time to be trusted again. You know, if you're known as someone who doesn't keep his word, then it's going to be hard for someone to rely upon your word. You know, we ought to be very careful in the vows that we make. We ought to be real careful in the promises that we make. And make sure that we make vows and make promises that we're able to keep. David sent out therefore spies and understood that Saul was coming in very deed. You know, David in the wilderness, when he saw this great army coming, he could have made assumptions. This is something that David probably has in his character 10 times more than I've got in my character. And it's a shame to say, but I know that this tendency comes after the flesh. You know what David did? David wanted to make sure first. There's an army coming, but who knows? Maybe it's an army of the Philistines. Maybe it's really not Saul's army. Or maybe it's a breakaway unit that broke away from Saul and are just out. Maybe, just maybe, they're both in the same area at the same time. Maybe Saul's just out there doing maneuvers. Maybe he doesn't even know that David is there. But David sent out spies to make sure that it was really Saul. I'm telling you something. Even though Saul had demonstrated over and over his character, David gave him somewhat of the benefit of the doubt. You ever met anybody that didn't automatically think evil of you? Unfortunately, that's not most Christians. You know, a rumor gets started. You know what you're going to do? You're going to most likely believe it right away. Aren't you? You believe something, somebody whispers something. Hey, did you see, have you heard about what brother so-and-so did the other day? Or sister so-and-so, and they begin to tell this thing. What's automatically going in your eye? Yeah, automatically in your mind you're thinking, you know something, that brother did have beady eyes. Really, this brother, you know, now that I think about it, and now that I look back, I understand that this brother right here, I could see the malice in his face. Yeah, he did it. You know, and then it turns out to be a complete lie. I almost got caught up in it the other day. I won't say who, what, when, or any circumstances. But it was exactly this very thing where something had taken place, and already in my mind I was saying, it's just like them. I mean, it's just like them to do something like that, you know? And already I was starting to get angry, and already I was starting, how dare he, you know? And then it turned out not more than 5 minutes later, when it all kind of came out, this particular person had nothing to do with the matter whatsoever. Do you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking, yeah, it's him. I remember I was painting a house the other day. Some of you guys know what I'm talking about. And I'm sitting there, and there's this kind of a light line around the ceiling. And I'm looking at one of my helpers. I said, I told that helper to paint better around that ceiling. I told that helper to do this. And I'm going on for 5 minutes about how I got to teach that helper to paint better around the ceiling. And then it came down. You know what that helper did? That helper never touched that ceiling. I painted that ceiling all the way around. I was the one who did that. And I'm going, oh, well, 5 minutes later, I'm up there with a brush fixing my mistakes, you know. Kind of embarrassing, you know. You know what I would say? The Bible says that love thinketh no evil. It doesn't say that love is gullible. It doesn't say that love is a doormat and allows everybody to walk over him. It doesn't say that love is stupid and trusts somebody that's not worthy to be trusted. But it does say that love thinketh no evil. You know, what is it about us that automatically wants us to think the worst of somebody? That wasn't David. David's the man after God's own heart. David gave them the benefit of the doubt. Let me tell you something. When you're judging others, you be real careful how you judge. Because sometimes what it looks like on the outside is not what the motivation of the heart is. There are sometimes people do things that may look bad on the outside, but their motives are pure and they've done it out of a good heart or maybe got caught up in something. You know, we ought to learn how to give each other a little space. Give each other the benefit of the doubt. Your husband, your wife, your kids. I mean, don't just automatically assume the worst. Send out spies first. Then you'll know the true matter. Brother Brian said, send out spies. All right. Yeah, sometimes you can take a verse and you can make an illustration, but then you can't go too far with it. Verse 5. It says, and David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched, and David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. You know, this is another thing that I guess is interesting about this, how incredible it is that here Saul is trying to find David and to seek him, and it seems like David always has the upper hand in the matter, that David always has the high ground. He's always the one who's in control. And truly, David was being led by the Lord. David was was putting his trust in the Lord. And I'm going to tell you something. When it comes to the battle we have to fight against evil, the Lord, He has the high ground. You may not think it. You may not understand it. You may think sometimes we are defeated. But I'm going to tell you something. God's got everything under control. We were studying in Revelation the other day in the classes. And we were looking at these hideous locusts that had come out of a bottomless pit that an angel from heaven had unlocked. And smoke and sulfur and fire and all of this wickedness that just belched out of this bottomless pit, which was hell, and just locusts everywhere. And it says that they had power on earth to torment men, and men cried out and they wanted to die. And it was obvious from the passage that men were in incredible pain and suffering during this time. But, you know, it said of these locusts that they had limitations. They could not bite anybody that had the seal of God on their forehead. They couldn't sting them. They only had power for 5 months, so their time was limited. And so it looked like chaos from the outset. If you were just sitting there in a place and saw this happening, you would just think utter, complete chaos, no control. God is gone. God is dead. But they have specific bounds and specific commands as to what to hurt, what not to hurt. They were told, don't you eat any grass or trees or hurt any vegetation. You only go after these men. I'm going to tell you something. Your enemy has bounds. The devil is not uncontrolled. You are not left to your own devices. In whatever it is that you've got to go through, understand this, that God has already set all of the parameters and He will not let Satan go a step farther than what God says he can go. You got to trust that. Because there's sometimes the devil will lie in your ear and says everything's chaos, it's all out of control. For the child of God, it's not out of control. You got to trust Him. And so David arose and he saw Saul laying there. And then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. You know, we have to wonder something about how quickly this Abishai said, yes, I'll go with thee. Because understand what David's wanting to do. Here's 3,000 men. Now, a king, when he goes out into an operation, when he wants to take 3,000 men, he doesn't go down and get the clerk typist out of the unit. He doesn't go down and grab the mechanics out of the motor pool. No, he gets the top of the line soldiers that he's got. He gets Abner's and he gets Joab's and he gets some of these great men and he puts them all around him. And look what it says here. It says, when they saw him, Saul lay in the trench. Okay, he dug a trench. That gives him some defense. And the people pitched round about him. And so it gives this illusion, this tremendous illusion of security. I mean, it just gives this idea that this is something so incredibly impenetrable. There's no way that we can gain victory. Isn't that a long time ago what some other Israelites thought when they looked at all of the land of the Canaan as they went through there? And they said, man, these guys got walled cities. We're grasshoppers in their sight. Look at how big they are, how tall they are. Sometimes we look at the obstacles more than we look at God. Sometimes we sit there and we give all the reasons why something can't be done. That's just in our nature. There's some people that have a tremendously optimistic nature and never see any hindrances and everything, but I don't understand those kind of people. Because when I look, I see, okay, I could get hurt there. I look at another thing and say, yeah, that would definitely hurt. That would be painful. You know, that would destroy my life. That would ruin me. You know, that would do this and that. And I can think of all kinds of reasons why not to do something. But you know something? For the child of God, there are no limitations. Didn't the Bible say we can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth us? I mean, I can jump off of a building. No, it doesn't mean I can tempt God. But it means if God's will designs for me to do something, I can do it in His strength, even though it looks like there is no possible way it can get done. Stop looking at the limitations and start looking at God a little bit. David wanted to go down there right in the middle of that army. So he took two people, Ahimelech and Abishai, and he said, hey, which one of you guys wants to go down with me? I'm the Abishai that's probably sitting there. I mean, not the Abishai. I wish I was the Abishai. I'm the Ahimelech. You know what I want to do? I want to sit there. Okay, well, let's analyze this first. Let's get us a plan of action going here. Come on, man. You want to just go down there? I mean, without any real plan, without any real focus, you just want to go and walk right into the enemy's camp? And Abishai, it didn't look like he even considered it. He just went with it. Okay, David, that's fine. Whatever you do, I'll do it with you. Is that what some of the disciples said when Jesus wanted to go back into the land? And they said, okay, we'll go die with you. They had no confidence, but they wanted to be with Jesus Christ. Let me tell you something. We can make all kinds of excuses why it would not be good for us to follow our King wholeheartedly, fully. I wonder sometimes, why isn't it that more Christians don't have this attitude of full and complete surrender to the will of the King? But Abishai, he was a man that said, man, this is what David wants to do. I'm going to be with him. And let me tell you, you can walk a yard from hell in the presence of God and you're going to be safer than if you're on a quiet city street out of the will of God. God knows how to protect His people. What are you afraid of? You're thinking in your mind, well, I really need to surrender this in my life. But you're not. You're holding back. What are you afraid of? What is it that you think is going to happen to you if you do the will of God? What is it in your mind that you think is going to be so terrible if you surrender yourself wholeheartedly to God's will? What do you think? God's going to just leave you off? God's going to make a bad example out of you? God is going to be cruel and just laugh at you and leave you off? No, I'm telling you, God, He'll take care of His children, and God will get glory to His name out of His children. And let me tell you something, if God decides to take you through a hard trail, and you've got to climb a steep slope, in the end, you're going to say, I am so glad that I surrendered myself to the Lord. But you know, you begin to look back, and you are too concerned with self-preservation, and you're too concerned with your own motivations and your own dreams, you're going to get to the end and you're going to look back and you know what you're going to say? I wished I'd have. I've met lots of people that say, you know, when I had that opportunity, I wished I'd have surrendered then. We heard it the other night, didn't we? God called me then. I wished I'd have done it then. But you know, I've never heard anybody giving a regret and saying to God, you know, when God called, I wished I'd never answered that call. You know, the only time you say that is in the bitterness of the flesh. When you look and you see, there are no regrets of serving God. And Abishai, he was ready. And so it's an amazing thing. They both went down there. Abner and the people lay round about him. They walked right up to the king. Remember the limitations? Remember the bounds that God puts on things? Remember what God can do? God can set that whole army asleep. And God, it says, put him to sleep down there in verse 12. There in the middle of the verse, it said, no man saw it nor knew it, neither awakened, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. You see, that's where the difference comes in. You see, you look at the power of man to be able to overcome the flesh and overcome difficulties, and we've got just our own resources to look after. But then you include the power of God, and God can do amazing things. Have you seen God take somebody full of bitterness, full of incredible, incredible wrath, and just turn their heart in a minute? I mean, we've heard stories, haven't we? Some of you have people in your families that was the case, that they were hard against the Lord, that they were angry against the Lord. I remember what God did in my own mother's heart. You know, my mother, there was one day she walked out of one of these services. And believe me, the brother was giving the address. She wasn't half wrong, you know, it was kind of a weird address. But, you know, I went to her later and I had to explain some things. I said, look, you see that guy that gave that message right there? I said, you know, 6 months ago he was on acid and could hardly talk. So this is a major miracle for us. Oh, okay. You know, she settled down a little bit. But, you know, she would not take anything from anybody. And I'm telling you, her heart was hard and I'd pray for her and I talked to her. It didn't help me too much. You know, I didn't really start out right because when I first got saved, I drove to Arizona, sat down across the table from my mother and I said, Mom, guess what? You're going to hell. You don't say that to a Polish matriarch. That was not the way to start things out. But you know, God did a work in my mother's heart. My mom calls me now. And instead of always, you know, the pressure, you know what we talk about now? She says, well, you know, I'm in this ministry in church right now, and but I really think that God could use me more in this ministry over here, so I've made a plan and I've started, and it really seems like, in fact, just the other day I was here and God really used, you know, and I'm thinking, and I just look at the phone sometimes and I said, this is coming out of my mother's mouth. That's the power of God over the flesh. Now, what are you going to choose? How are you going to live your life? You know, how are you going to set your standards? You're going to look at something and you're going to say, I am not even going to try because God can't do anything. I can't do anything. It is impossible. Let me tell you something. When we look at something that is impossible, it is possible with God. And that's not just this superficial, all positive, you know, everything is love and flowers everywhere kind of preaching. You know, where you can do anything, go out there and make $1 million, go out there and fulfill your destiny. No, it's not that kind of preaching. It is just this solid, practical trust that God has power over man and God can break down barriers. He can do that in our own bodies. Sometimes we get a little discouraged, don't we, when we're fighting the natural man? Natural man ever get you down? You ever get to the place where you got to bow your knee and you got to tell the Lord what you did again? What you thought again? And you thought, man, I thought I had victory over that last week. But then it raises its head again. Well, you know, that's just the nature of the flesh. You expect it. The flesh is not ever going to, you got to kill it. You got to constantly beat it. You got to hit it with a club, and when it pops its head back up, you got to hit it with a club again. You can't reason with it. You can't do anything. You just got to nail it with the Word of God. Do you know the power of God? Oh, man, I'm telling you what, He can do some things. I was ashamed of the way that I was living before I got saved. The things that I did are not things that I'm proud of. They're things that I'm shameful of. I mean, they're things that were destroying my life, that were damaging me, that were hindering me at every turn. And Jesus Christ came into my heart and He defeated a whole bunch of things. God had mercy on me. And I have to say today, it is God that put those things to sleep. I looked at that and I said, how in the world am I? I've already tried. I've already done the rubber band. I've already done all these things. Nothing worked. No self-help. But God, He did it. So they got this great illusion of safety. And you know the story. They went down there and Abishai, you know, in his zealousness, he's there before David. And I mean, they're inches from Saul's head and Abishai, they're whispering back and forth. And Abishai said, take the spear, I'll put it right into his ear, right through the other ear, right into the ground, and I won't have to do it a second time, you know. And man, I'm telling you what, that sounds like a good plan. And remember back when Saul was in the cave, back when they were hiding in the shadows of the cave, remember what they had said? They said, man, he delivered him right into our hands. But understand this, that there's a difference between the principles God gives and the circumstances that you see. There are some times when everything concerning the circumstances says that it's right. Sometimes people are praying, you know, God, if you don't want me to have this job, then just close the door. Well, what if God doesn't want you to have the job, but He doesn't close the door? What if they offer you this job that's going to steal you away from God's people? Are you going to take it and say, well, that's what God offered me and He didn't shut the door. So therefore, you know, there are times when God wants you to do a little bit of thinking. When you can't just look up and see which way the wind is blowing and said, ah, that obviously is the will of God. Because there are times when things will be set up for you and you are going to have to make a good decision even though the circumstances may be on the other side of that decision. You see, we don't live by sight. We live by faith. We look in this book right here and we learn how to live, how to make decisions, what to do, what's right, what's wrong. And God expects us to take that knowledge and to use it in our lives. So don't just look at circumstances and just conclude that because things look right, that they are right. See, David had a real problem here. Because where did the temptation come from? Came from circumstances, but where did it come from? It came from Abishai was his cousin, you know, and Abishai is related to him. He was the son of David's sister, Zariah. And so he's close kin, man. They fought battles together. They're real close. And you know, when somebody that you love and trust gives you advice, you know, sometimes even that advice can be wrong. Some people have said, well, you know, that brother so-and-so told me to do this, and they don't investigate it, they don't talk about it, they don't seem to analyze it, they just simply, okay, well, brother so-and-so said do this, and just do it. Listen, we can't even trust each other all the time. You may be giving some advice on somebody, you know, and that person that you're asking advice of, you know, should I confront this person? Maybe the other person's in a bad mood, and they're having a bad day, and they say, nail him. Don't let him get away with it. Maybe the other person's got something against that brother. And you might get some bad advice. So you got to watch out where temptation comes from. Temptation may come from the ones that you love the most. From the closest ones to you. That's where temptation may come from. No, better to base ourselves on the Word of God. Let it be our stay. And so David, he's listening to Abishai here and he says, no, I can't destroy whom God anoints. I can't stretch forth my hands against the Lord's anointed. And he says something interesting here in verse 10. He says, David said, furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. Isn't that just like the verse that says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord? Isn't that what he's saying? If God wants him dead, God will kill him. I don't have to do it. I'm not going to play the judge and jury on this matter. I'm going to let God do it. I'm going to let God be the one. It's what he said last time when he cut off Saul's skirt. It was the same thing. And so You know, we get to a place in this passage right here where the situation's already set up. They snuck in. God caused a deep sleep to fall on the men. They grabbed the spear. They grabbed the bolster. They got out, went down into the valley, went up the other side, stood on the hillside, and then they called out to Abner. And you know, to me, when I read this part, I'm just so filled with pride. You know, I'm filled with victory. You know, I'm filled with, I told you so, you know, because this is where it's at right here. When you've already demonstrated that you could have killed a man, when you've demonstrated that you could have destroyed his life, but then you held back and you proved to him that you're not who you think you are. You know, when you stand up on the other side of the hill and you hold the spear up, "Hey, Abner, how come you weren't guarding the king? Hey, I thought you were a valiant man." You know, he begins to taunt Abner. When you're reading this, you better be careful, though, who you taunt. Because when David took the kingdom, for 2 years he had Judah. But forgot the name of the other king. Ish-bosheth, somebody like that. He was over the 10 kings. And guess who put him in power? It was Abner, the general. You see, if David had somehow not embarrassed Abner in public, maybe, and allowed him to save a little bit of faith, maybe been a little more compassionate to him, didn't taunt him, didn't build up his resentment, it could have been very possible that Abner would have delivered all the other kingdoms and all the other of Saul's house over to David, and he could have had the whole kingdom all at once. But because of this, there was a period of time where there was some real resentment and some opposition there. And you know, I think about this and I think, you know, you be careful what kind of bridges you burn. Some Christians in their zealousness will go so far and really go too hard on somebody and get too personal and end up burning some bridges that they might need later on. But I don't want to say that to discount this. Because what you see here, he describes himself, of course, as a flea, as a little partridge in the mountains. And somehow you may think, you know, David's such a wimp. He's not even willing to fight Saul. Well, no, I'm telling you something. David is willing to fight Saul if he had to. Look at what David did to the Philistines. See, David was sitting there cowering behind some bush somewhere saying, "Oh man, the Philistines are coming. What are we going to do?" No, David was leading the charge. David was out in front of the pack, and David didn't stop until his enemy was destroyed. David was the one who had the guts to go down into Saul's camp and to sneak right up to the king in the face. He didn't know God was going to put a deep sleep on the men. Let me tell you what David is. David is not weak. David is not a wimp. He's not a sissy. There's a word that could be used to describe, and it's a Bible word, and it's called bold. You know what David was speaking of here? With confidence. You know what we don't need to apologize for? We don't need to apologize for who we serve or what we are. You know what David did? The rest of this thing, it wasn't Saul that was in control of this conversation. It was David. Where is it that we get the idea that because the world is putting pressure on Christianity and said, "You can't talk here, you can't do this, you can't bring your Bible to school, you can't pray in school, you can't go over here or over there," and they put all these limitations on us, that somehow that means that we just gotta kind of sneak around in the shadows. You know something? I'm telling you, I am proud to belong to Jesus Christ. It doesn't cause me any shame at all. I mean, Jesus hung on a cross naked for me. Why should I be embarrassed of Him? And David, when he was speaking, he spoke with the confidence. Look at just real quick. He said, in verse 18, and he said, "Wherefore doth my Lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done, and what evil is in my hand?" Two things here that brought David confidence. The first of all is when he says, "Why do you pursue after your servant?" You know something? Who was Saul's friend? In this whole scenario, who was Saul's friend? Was it Abner? Abner could not even, he had no strength to protect his own king. Who was Saul's friend? It was David. The one who could have killed him, the one who could have taken his life. You know, we're in the business of trying to explain to the world is that God is not their enemy. God is their friend. In fact, their parents don't love them like God loves them. Their family doesn't love them like God loves them. Their friends on the street don't love them like God loves them. People are looking and they're seeing, "Well, God hates me, but all my gang members around here, they all love me." You know something? They don't love you. Not like God does, because if they loved you, they'd tell you the truth. You know something? They can call you enemy all they want to, but if you're a preacher of the gospel, you are the best friend the lost world has ever had. Because you're after their welfare. So, don't get excited or bent out of shape because they hate you. Understand that this can give us confidence. If they say, oh man, get that stuff out of here. Man, we don't want to hear that. All that archaic stuff about the Bible. Don't let it hit your ears for 1 minute. Don't worry about it. You just do what God tells you to do. Have this confidence in your message that you are their friend and you are actually going to do them some good by preaching the gospel to them. He also says, and we don't have time to read it, but in verse 11, verse 16, verse 23, and verse 24, in all of these particular verses right here, he ascribes things to the Lord. You see, that's where our true confidence lies. It lies in God. It doesn't lie in the approval of any man. You know, stop looking for the approval of the world. Stop looking for an Abner or a Saul to say, hey man, you're a great guy. Don't wait for that to happen. Because we see with Saul, Saul told David before, hey man, you're a great guy. You're going to be king. And he lied through his teeth. Don't believe anything that they say. Your confidence is in the Lord. And so what I would say, just rounding this out, look in verse 24. We'll use this to close it out. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord. And let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Let me tell you, in your battle with the flesh, in your battle with the natural man, in your confrontations with the things of the world, never forget that God is your source of power, He's your source of strength, and He's going to be your source of inspiration, He's going to be your source for everything. Put all of your confidence in the Lord, and you will never have to be apologetic towards man, or be weak or undecided before man. You can be as bold as a lion, like Proverbs says. The wicked pursue or flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. May God give us the confidence to be bold like David was.